For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.
It's February 11th. We are in Shmuel Beis and Perek Yud Gimel, chapter 13. We went through the story last time of Tamar and Amnon, and we raised all kinds of questions and issues, which we're going to attempt to deal with at least partially tonight. Before we do so, or in order to do so, I'm going to share with you a Gemara in Maseches Sanhedrin. It's on Ayin Hey Amun Alf, that's 75a. It's an actual story that happened, and the way that Chazal, that our sages, dealt with it is, I believe, a window into understanding this episode of Amnon and Tamar. It's going to deal specifically with a man who has become lovesick over a particular woman, which is what happened with Amnon and Tamar. And that's why I believe it is a window. Now, the Gemara tells us that it actually happened that a man, there's a maisa, a story happened, the person, it says, Nasan Einav Beisha Achas, he put his eyes on a particular woman, and it's the language of the Gemara, it's Hela Libotina, which means his heart became sick. I mean, he literally became sick. The doctors of the day said that if he is unable to have an intimate relationship with this woman, he will die. That's how bad it was. Now, we don't have to question medically whether it's accurate or not. Perhaps it was causing other types of complications. Who knows? Perhaps. But it doesn't really matter. Because as long as that was the accepted medical prognosis, right, then the halacha has to deal with what the medicine says. So the halacha is going to deal with a life and death situation. It's going
to
treat this as a... What's that? That is the level this is going to be put on. The person is going to die. The presumption is he's actually going to die. So the Gemara says, Amru Chachamim, the sages said, Yomus Va'alti Bo'elo. He has to die, and she may not have a relationship with him, an intimate relationship with him. That is prohibited, and therefore he must die.
Was she married?
Okay, so we're going to discuss that.
Okay.
The Gemara then says that the doctors apparently backtracked a little bit, and they said, well, okay, Tamar Lefanav Aruma, let her stand before him without clothing, and that will deal with the problem. Right. So the sages said, Yomos Val Tamar Lefanav Aruma, he must die, and she may not stand before him without clothing. Then the doctors said, Tisapro Imo Me'achori HaGoder, let her talk to him from behind a wall. And when you see the word God there, wall, it usually means a stone wall. So that means you can't even see her.
That's a big step down from the last.
That's right. That's right. So they've downgraded it. She'll be behind the wall. They'll be on either side of a wall. He won't be able to see her. And she will talk to him. And that will prevent his death. The sage has said, Yomus velo tisaper imo me'achori HaGoder, he must die. And she may not speak to him from behind the wall. Okay. So the Gemara then tells us, if she was a married woman, so we can understand, obviously, it's adultery, and even lower levels of that is prohibited. We know the rule is, there's such a thing called abizrayu. Abizrayu means a downgraded version of the same thing. Just as you have to give up your life for any of the three worst sins, the avodah zarah, idolatry, gilui arayos, immorality, and ritzicha, and murder, you have to give up your life even for abizrayu, even for a something that is within their category, even if it isn't the actual act. So that just as it is prohibited to have an intimate relationship with a married woman, it's also prohibited to have any kind of non-physical intimacy is also prohibited. That's also prohibited. Now, it may not be the type of thing that if it's done will put them to death, but it still falls under the general rubric of adultery. And therefore, even though if one does it, they're not killed for it, but if one is threatened with death or do it, he has to die. If a non-Jew puts a gun to a man's head and says, I want you to have a non-physical, intimate relationship with a married woman, he has to let him pull the trigger. Can't do it. Even though, if he would do it, he wouldn't be put to death for it. See, you understand what the distinction we're drawing over here? Mm-hmm. Even though the punishment for the act is not death, one still has to give up their life rather than do it. So, if she's a married woman, we can understand, we can't let it go at all. The man has to die, and we can't let any form, because obviously this is not platonic. If it's going to be in order because he's lovesick, no matter what it is, even if it's just talking to him, it's going to have some element of intimacy involved. Okay, fine. But the Gemara itself asks the question, if she was a single woman, then the Gemara's language is very interesting language. My kulehai, what's the big deal? That's the Gemara's question. What's the big deal? Okay, so it's not, I understand, this is not the way we would rather things be. Okay, but the fact is, the man's going to die. So he's going to die, so save his life. What's the big deal? So the Gemara says the reason is, and we can understand this, because shlo yu binosis or putzos barayas, because it will cause promiscuity. Because as Rashi explains, what will happen is, if we would permit this, then any young woman who has an interest in a particular man will deliberately place herself in front of him so that he will become lovesick or claim to be lovesick, and they'll get a heter. They'll get permission. So you're promoting a promiscuous society if you allow this to go. We can't promote, we can't allow that.
Right.
And you see what goes on in the world today. We of all people don't need the Gemara to tell us this. We know that once you start to let this sort of thing go, the place falls apart. And that's what goes on in our culture. So the Gemara here anticipated this and said, you can't allow this sort of practice to go on. And therefore the man has to die, which is an unbelievable thing. We cannot save his life. So the Gemara asks what is probably the obvious question. The Gemara says, "Linsiv minsiv, let them get married." Okay, now if she refuses, it's one thing. But if she's willing, at least pursue the possibility.
Mm-hmm.
Let them get married.
Mm-hmm.
You're dealing with a man's life. So maybe he shouldn't have allowed himself to get to the point that he got to. But that doesn't mean he should die. He's not an evil man. So he didn't do a sin yet. So let him live, let them get married. What's the big deal? Now this is critical. The next line is critical of the Gemara, but also what I'm going to tell you Rashi says over here. It's critical you hear what Rashi says. Rashi says, let them get married. Now, that will solve this particular problem. But what about the promiscuity issue? Didn't we say we didn't want to allow this to go anywhere because we're afraid that girls or women, young women will deliberately
entice
a man.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't want that to happen. Rashi says, so what? So what? Let the women do it. Rashi says, listen to the language of Rashi. Rashi says, Dein kan prutzos barayos. That won't be promiscuous. Dekulo levet hachi. Let them all do that. Let all the girls do it. Velinsivan. And then they'll get married. Vein kan avera. There won't be an avera here. Ella mitzvah.
Mm-hmm. That's nice.
You'll make shiduchim.
Right.
It'll be beautiful.
Right.
Let all the girls parade around in front of the guys.
Right.
Let the
right.
guys get lovesick over them.
Mm-hmm.
Shiduchim.
Mm-hmm.
We'll marry them all off.
Mm-hmm.
Solve the shidduch crisis.
Yeah.
It's beautiful.
And
it's wonderful.
We get that in Tu B'Av, right?
We're going to get the Tu B'Av.
Okay.
Good. So the Gemara is asking, what's the big deal? So they'll get married.
Mm-hmm.
You'll make shiduchim. It's not just you'll solve the problem. You'll do a mitzvah.
Mm-hmm.
Let's promote this behavior. Don't discourage it. Promote it. And it's wonderful. The Gemara answers, this is critical. The Gemara answers, Lo miyasva daite. It will not settle his mind. It will not solve the problem. If they get married, making her permissible to him, he will not, it will not curb what was the problem in the first place.
Oh, this is very interesting.
He was interested in a sin.
Mm-hmm.
Once you make her permitted to him, you will not solve the problem. Now, we know this we know this to be true. We all can attest to this in various aspects, that when something is prohibited, it has an allure that isn't there if it's permitted. The Gemara says this case will not be solved by letting them get married. It will not help. He had an interest in a sin, not in something permitted, and that allure cannot be solved by permitting her to him. Now, the Gemara says, though, this is actually dependent on something. The Gemara says this is based on something Rav Yitzchak said. Because Rav Yitzchak said, Miyom shecharav Beis HaMikdash, from the day the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, nitla ta'am bia v'nitla l'ovrei avera. The literally means the taste, but it means the enjoyment of intimacy was taken away and given to those who commit sins. Once the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, then committing a sin became more enjoyable than doing the same act in a permissible way. As the verse says, Shenemar, Mayim genuvim yimtaku, stolen water is sweeter. For lechem sisarim yinaim, same thing with bread that is hidden away, is more pleasant, tastes better. So the Gemara tells us that you can't solve a desire for a sin simply by giving a kosher substitute.
Right.
Even if the exact same taste. A person desires pork, you give them a pork, it tastes exactly like, this tastes exactly the same as pork. It will not solve the problem. Now, of course, a person can solve the problem themselves with their own Yirah Shamayim, with their own fear of heaven. A person can pull themselves away from the brink of wanting to do a sin with their own work. But just to substitute does not solve the problem. That is not in and of itself going to work. But the Gemara says this is dependent on the fact that the Beis HaMikdash has been destroyed. Prior to the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, this solution would have worked. Because prior to the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, which I can't give you a logical explanation for this, but we can talk about spiritual reasons for this, but prior to the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, a physical act that was done in a permissible way was just as enjoyable as done in a prohibited fashion. Therefore, prior to the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, had this story happened and she would have been a single girl, let them get married. What are you worried about? It's going to cause promiscuity? It won't cause promiscuity. It'll cause shiduchim. It'll cause mitzvahs. It'll be great. Let them do it. And that's what Tu B'Av is all about. See, everybody asks this question with Tu B'Av. This is my answer to Tu B'Av. Is this Gemara? Everybody asks with Tu B'Av. The girls would dance, and the guys would come, and they would pick out shidduchim. Be great. So everybody says today, so what's wrong with mixed dancing? What's wrong with, all this flirting that goes on? What's wrong with it? It's Tu B'Av. You're making shidduchim. The answer is Tu B'Av only works prior to the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. Tu B'Av does not work in our culture. Because in our culture, a sinful relationship is more enjoyable than a permitted relationship. And therefore, if you're going to entice the men in a sinful manner, it will not help to marry them. And all you're going to do is create unhappy marriages. As we see, it goes on throughout the United States all the time, not just, I'm talking in secular circles. Two people become enamored with each other, but it's in a non-committed way. It is somewhat sinful, even for those who don't believe it's a sin to have a relationship out of wedlock. But there's something alluring about it. It's not with any commitment. It's just to have fun. And when that later develops into a marriage, that's when things start to fall apart. Because then it becomes a chore. There's no longer the excitement. There's no longer the sinful element to it. And today you can't substitute one for the other. It doesn't work. That's why the whole notion of just put boys and girls together, let's have a co-ed school and we'll create shidduchim. It doesn't work. It doesn't work. It may appear to work a short term, but it doesn't really work. But prior to the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, it did work. That's why Tu B'Av worked. That's why it was successful.
But not prior to the building of the Beis HaMikdash?
Okay, so I believe that prior to the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash includes prior to the building. It's prior to the building of the Beis HaMikdash would also work. It would also be fine. Because the reason, difference between prior to the destruction and after the destruction is the level of spirituality in the world. The greater the level of spirituality there is in the world, then that element, the allure of the sin, isn't that alluring. And for lack of a better word, the allure of a mitzvah is also exciting. It's exciting to do a mitzvah. We need to excite ourselves to do a mitzvah. It's not easy to be excited to do a mitzvah. We have to make it exciting for our children. We have to make it exciting. So perhaps some mitzvahs are easier to make exciting than others. Purim is a little bit easier to make exciting than Yom Kippur. I admit that. But it's still, we have to create the atmosphere and make it exciting. Prior to the destruction of Beis HaMikdash, I believe that there was an inherent excitement to do a mitzvah because you actually experienced getting closer to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. There was a sense of that. And that was exciting. Yes, there was an allure with an Avera also, but it wasn't as exciting because the Avera also drew you away from Hashem. And it was much more real. So prior to the destruction, even prior to the construction, there Tu B'Av and this story could have, Tu B'Av worked and this story could have been saved. But once the world has plummeted to where it's plummeted to, it doesn't work anymore.
When you say prior to the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash...
Which Beis HaMikdash?
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought you were going to ask that question. I don't know. I don't know the answer. It seems,
I hear that expression often.
Yes, it seems that Tu B'Av took place during the second Beis HaMikdash, which would be an unbelievable thing that this system would work even at the lower level of spirituality of the second Beis HaMikdash. Even then, it would have worked. But not today.
So it's interesting that Rashi, even all these years later, would say, so what?
Well, the Gemara says so what, and Rashi explains it. The Gemara says so what.
So he didn't say so what.
No.
But why is Rashi saying this is a good idea if it's all worked out?
Rashi's explaining that it would be a mitzvah.
So that wasn't Rashi saying all that.
Rashi did say that. It's like this. The Gemara asks the question, why don't you let them get married?
Okay.
And as Rashi explains, if that would work, if getting married would work, then there's no. It's great. Okay. Go ahead, do it, and let all the girls do it.
So he didn't say all that, okay.
Right? Well, you said a lot of it.
I get it.
Once the Gemara answers, it's not going to work. Then it's not going to work. Okay. Then,
this is very insightful.
It's unbelievable.
I'm always so astounded, at the insights here.
Yeah, it's an amazing Gemara, and I really feel that this is the answer to Tu B'Av. I've never seen anybody else make this. Make this connection, but I believe that this is.
You should write that up and publish it.
I've said it many times. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu Melech Haolam she'akol nivra.
Well, that's really a remarkable amount of insight packed into a very short.
Yeah. Now, let's move to Amnon and Tamar.
Yes.
Okay, because now this gives us a little bit of a window.
Okay.
Amnon and Tamar are living at a time of very great spirituality.
Yeah.
The Beis HaMikdash isn't built yet, but we're on the cusp of the building of the Beis HaMikdash. I mean, we're ready. David HaMelech has made the country primed for the Beis HaMikdash. We're ready to go over here. All we need is Shlomo HaMelech, and we're good to go. So the spirit level of spirituality is very high. Nevuah prophecy is rampant. I mean, it's the connections to Hashem are powerful. So we have to believe, therefore, that in the time of Amnon and Tamar, an act that is done in a sinful manner could be easily substituted for the same act being done in a permissible manner. Now remember, Amnon and Tamar were, as we explained last week, Amnon and Tamar were biologically half-brother and sister, but halachically were not related. Therefore, they were technically permitted to each other. Tamar says to Amnon, and the Gemara says what she was saying was true. She wasn't just trying to push him off. It was actually true. She said to Amnon, don't do this. Speak to the king, to our father, to David. He will not deny me to you. That's what she said. And it's true, because she was technically permitted to him. They were not halachic brother and sister. Legally, they were not brother and sister. Yet, Amnon refused. Mm-hmm. Amnon, nevertheless, continued with the act. Now, the question is, why did he continue? We can answer that one of two ways. We can either answer, he was a bad person. He wanted to sin. He wasn't interested in marrying her. He was interested in the sin. That's all he was interested in. We could say that. But the other way to understand it, and I want to show you that I believe that Amnon never actually intended to go this far. But the other way to understand it is that once he was this far along, he could no longer resist. Now, what do I mean by this far along? The man here in the story is also pretty far along, right? So, what are we talking about here? So, let's review the events of Tamar and Amnon. Amnon is lovesick over Tamar. That Navi tells us explicitly that he's lovesick. It says in Pasuk Beis verse 2, it says, "Vayetzel Amnon lehispchalos." It was painful to Amnon to the point that he became sick. He was literally ill because he could not have a relationship with her. So Yonadav, who is evil, or at least has an evil suggestions, tells Amnon, "I'll tell you what you should do. You should lie in bed sick." As we mentioned last week, he doesn't have to fake it. He really is sick. David is going to come to visit you, and when he comes, say to him, "I let Tamar, my sister, come and let her feed me a meal. She should make the meal in front of me, then I should see her, and I'll eat from her hand." Now, we asked last week, that's pretty explicit.
Yeah.
There's very little over there that's left to doubt. Yet, David, after Amnon, he goes to visit Amnon, asks for almost everything. He doesn't say it exactly the way Yonadav said it. He leaves out one or two details, as the Mefarshim point out, but the fact is, it's still pretty explicit. And David says, he agrees. He sends to Tamar to go to Amnon's house. Now we ask the question, what was David thinking? We're going to get back to that. That's the last point we'll cover this evening. We're going to come back to that question. But Tamar goes. Now, was Amnon intending over here to actually physically molest Tamar against her will? So we pointed out that that's not the case. Because even when he grabs her, he says to her, then have a relationship with me. He believes at that point that she might actually do it with consent.
Mm-hmm.
That's what he believes. Okay. But did he even have in mind to actually do this the entire time? What was his intent? Tamar goes, she makes the meal for him. Now, I want to mention a side over here. We asked last week that the Gemara itself, in Pasuk Ches, verse 8, the Gemara makes the point of what type of bread she made for him. That she boiled it and she fried it. I think there was something else too, right? She boiled it. She formed it, boiled it, fried it.
Poured them out.
Yeah, poured it out for him. Right, it seems like it's a very elaborate type of thing, which was pointed out last week. Which means she's skilled at doing it. I know somebody asked last week that how could a princess be skilled at doing it. I don't think that's the case. I actually think that much to the
chagrin.
No, not chagrin. Much to the in contrast to the stereotype of the Jewish princess. We'll leave out the word American. I think that Jewish princesses actually knew how to cook and bake quite well. I think that they were. None of them were interested in being on a pedestal, and none of them were trained to be on a pedestal. I doubt highly that was the case. But at any rate, she obviously is skilled at doing this. It's an elaborate process, which was pointed out last week, that she's involved in this for a long time. Which means that if he's watching her for a long time, involved in many things. But it is worthwhile noting that in the Chumash, which actually on Sunday nights we're going to get to this pretty soon, in the various types of menachos, of flower offerings, there are various types, many different types of flower offerings, some that are baked, and some that are some are fried, and so there's various types that are done. The type that is brought by the Kohen Gadol is a type that is boiled. I'm pretty sure it's boiled, baked, and fried. All three. It's done that. He has to bring it every day. It seems that that process is considered to be a delicacy. Something, if you have flour and water and oil and you want to make something really good, it seems like this is like the top of the line. I don't know exactly what it tasted like. It was the Kohen Gadol's, it wasn't eaten, it was burned. But the I don't know exactly what it tasted like or how it was done, or but it seems like here we're mimicking a little bit that.
That's interesting.
That finest of breads. That's what it seems to me is happening over here.
Sounds like a donut.
Right. It sounds like a combination of a bagel and a donut. Right. Right?
Yeah.
A bonut. I don't know. It certainly was not a healthy thing to eat. Right. We're talking about something really, you know, really, really good. So she makes this thing. She pours it in front of him. And then Amnon says, everybody leave. They all leave. Then Amnon says to Tamar, bring it to me to the room, and I will eat directly from your hands. In Pasuk Yud, verse 10. Tamar takes it, she comes she brings it to Amnon, her brother, to the room. She, in Yud Aleph 11, Vatagen she'elav la'echol, she brings it before him to eat. Vayachazek ba, he grabs her, Vayomelon, he says to her, bo ishichvi imi achosi. You should have an intimate relationship with me, my sister. We pointed out last week that my sister is a funny thing to say.
Yeah.
What is he emphasizing? My sister. Why is he saying that? And the entire time, he emphasizes his sister. All the way from the beginning, he's interested in his sister. He says to Yonadav, I'm interested in the sister of my brother, Abshalom. He says to David, my sister. He's my sister over and over again. Tamar responds in Yud Beis, Al Achi, don't my brother, don't molest me, because this is not done in Yisrael. She says in Yud Gimel in 13, she says, where will I take my shame? And you'll be like one of the despicable ones amongst the Jews. And now speak to the king, he will not hold me back from you. So, and then he says he refused. Now, we could understand that he was plotting this the entire time. The entire time, this is what he was plotting. To me, it's a little bit lacking that when the Navi tells us Yonadab's plan to Amnon, he says, lie in bed, sick, the king will come to visit you, and ask him that Tamar should come and make the meal for you. In front of you, you'll be able to look at her, and she'll feed you. I understand that we could understand that we're meant to fill in the blank. And then obviously, you'll seize the opportunity and you'll molest her. Right? I think that that the Navi could have been more explicit. If that was the plan, Yonadav would have said that to Amnon and Amnon would have accepted it. It just fill in the rest of the plan. You'll ask the king, let her come, let her, then you'll say, everybody leave the room, and then you'll do what you want. Spell it out. He doesn't spell it out. I don't believe that this was Yonadav's nor Amnon's intent that it should go this far. I believe that Yonadav's advice was still evil. It was the wrong thing to advise. This is not the way to deal with a terrible desire. I don't believe that Yonadav was not advising nicely. But at the same time, I don't believe either of them expected to go this far. He has to throw everybody out of the room in order to grab her. He could have sent everybody out of the room beforehand. Instead, he throws them out of the room at this juncture, when she's ready to feed him. That's when he throws everybody out of the room. It's to me, I believe, that things are spiraling out of control.
Mm-hmm.
My proof to this, I want to kind of prove, my indication that this is correct, is the following. We mentioned last week that the Gemara tells us that as a result of this story, David and his basin and his court enacted the law of yichud, of seclusion. As we mentioned last week, yichud with a married woman, seclusion with a married woman, is prohibited from the Torah. But seclusion amongst two people who are not married to each other, even though they may not be allowed to have an out-of-wedlock relationship, but it's still not to the level of adultery, and therefore, typically, yichud, seclusion, amongst two people that could marry each other, even though they're not married right now, is permitted from the Torah. But after this episode, David banned that. And that stands still today. That is our prohibition against unmarried people being in seclusion comes from this story. That's been in effect, in force ever since. Yichud, seclusion, is not a law that speaks to evil people. It seems like this. You have two people, man and woman. They are out to commit a sin. They're out to commit a sin. Married, not married, whatever it is, they are out to have a relationship out of wedlock. That's what they're out to do. So you tell them, you know what? You're not allowed to be in the same room alone with each other without anybody able to get in. That's what you tell them. Are they going to listen? Why would they listen? They're out to sin. They're not going to listen to this. Why would they listen?
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to stop anything. What, because they're not allowed to be alone with each other? I mean, they're interested in much more than that.
Mm-hmm.
The law of Yichud is speaking to two people who are God-fearing people who are out to do the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because what Yichud says is this. When you take two people who are God-fearing, who are out to do the right thing, and you put them in a room alone with each other in seclusion where no one is going to barge in, the barriers break down. The barriers between each other and the barriers between themselves and sin, meaning how God-fearing they are. The Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination, has a powerful way of grabbing hold of somebody when there's no ability for a human being to enter. Although we know that it's true that God can always see, but Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai gave a blessing, gave a bracha to his students on his deathbed. May the fear of heaven be for you the same level as your fear of man. That's what he told them. They said, Rebbe, Ad Kan, that's it? Don't we want our fear of heaven to be more than our fear of man? Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai said, no, I'll prove it to you. A person goes by himself and says, I want to do a sin. No one should see me. What do you mean no one should see you? God can see you. But that's not as great a deterrent to people as people seeing. Other people becoming aware of what's going on is a much greater deterrent to sin. Because people are worried about their own reputations. People are worried about what other people are going to say. And especially when you have two people where the barriers between them, you know, we live in a society where men and women interact with each other, talk to each other regularly. And that is a relatively modern idea. And as you probably understand, it's not really kosher. It's not supposed to be like this. There should be a natural barrier that exists. Just if you think back to grade school, when the whatever age it was for you in grade school, when the boys and girls were they were inhibited from talking to each other. They were they want to, but they're not going to. They're kind of like that. That's the way it should be with adults also. There should be this natural barrier that no one is easily going to cross. When you take two people, put them in a room alone with each other, and there's no threat of anybody walking in, the barriers break down. And then two God-fearing people can end up doing a sin. That's what Yichud addresses. It addresses people who are God-fearing. Over here, if Amnon was intent on doing the sin from the beginning, so it's true Yichud would address the problem because Tamar wasn't interested in doing this in the first place. So by outlawing Yichud, then you never have a situation where a man who's intent on molesting a woman can have the woman alone with him in a room with no one else around because you can't be alone. But it's clear Amnon wasn't interested initially in molestation. he was interested in a consensual relationship. He says to her, join me. He doesn't try to force her at first, which means he believed that what he wanted is what she wanted. Why did he believe that? Because whatever was going on for Amnon, where one thing led to another and it spiraled out of control, he thought the same thing's going on for her. He thought that she's also becoming interested.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what? It is possible that he was right. It is possible that she was becoming interested. Now, there's no indication of that in the Pesukim. I'm not suggesting that to be the truth.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just saying that there's no indication against it either. We don't know what happened over there. But it seems like he got signals that she might be interested. Now, she was more God-fearing than he was. Even if she was interested, she was more God-fearing than he was. She says, let's do this in a permissible manner. She didn't say to him, I won't marry you. She said, let's do this in a permissible manner. Now, it's possible she was just trying to push him off, but it's also possible that she really meant it. I'll marry you. I'm interested in you. I'm attracted. It could be she meant that. It could be. I don't know. I don't want to accuse Tamar of something that isn't true. I mean, Tamar is a tremendous tzaddikus. Chas v'shalom. What I'm pointing out to you is that there's no indication in the Pesukim that Tamar was repulsed by him, had no interest, and he obviously he read some message that she was interested. So he says to her, so let's go about it. And she says, let's do it in a permissible manner. So I am suggesting to you that this does fit perfectly into the Yichud scenario.
Yeah.
This wasn't a case of planned molestation.
Mm-hmm.
This was a case of a man who was lovesick, who said, let me at least talk to her from behind the wall.
Mm-hmm.
Let me at least have her in my room, preparing a meal in front of me, feeding me. Let me at least have that. If I can't have a relationship with her, at least let me have that. That's what's going on over here. To me, this is an exact replica of what happened in the Gemara. The only difference is that this was prior to the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. Therefore, marrying her would have solved the problem. The problem over here was he didn't think he could get her hand in marriage because biologically they were related. And it wasn't normal. He didn't normally do this, even though, yes, technically speaking, it's permitted for them to marry, but it was not generally done. Amnon believed if he would go to David and say, I am absolutely lovesick, I want to marry my sister, David either would have said no, or Amnon would have been ashamed to say that he feels that way about his sister. But remember, we said something else last week, and I'll get to your question in just a moment. Remember we said last week that prior to the construction of the second Beis HaMikdash, remember what we said last week, brothers and sisters did have an interest in each other. Maybe not the same as unrelated people, but there was some interest in each other. Remember I told you last week, the way you raised boys and girls would have to be different than the way we raise them today. Because today there's a presumption that they are absolutely disinterested in each other, which is generally the case. But in their day, that cannot be presumed. So it wouldn't be crazy for Amnon to say, I have an interest in my biological sister, especially she's a half-sister. It wouldn't be crazy. But he didn't think that David would allow them to marry. Or maybe he was too embarrassed to go down that road, and he didn't want to actually marry because he was afraid of going down that road. So Yonadav gives him the next best suggestion, which is really a terrible suggestion,
mm-hmm.
which is, look, if you can't actually have the physical relationship, at least you'll get something. You'll be able to watch her, you'll be able to talk to her, you'll be able to be fed by her, you'll get that. So you'll placate the Itar in some manner. Yeah.
If Tamar herself came up with the suggestion that they simply asked David and that they get married and knew that they were halakhically permitted to each other, surely Amnon knew all this as well.
Right.
And Yonadav knew it as well.
Yes. So I believe that they knew she was technically permitted, but either Amnon was embarrassed to ask or he was afraid David would say no.
Tamar wasn't either
right.
embarrassed or afraid.
So, but once they got to the point where, so they now they're under, now he throws everybody out of the room. And he's looking now for more. And the fact that now they're alone, the Yetzer Hara goes into overdrive.
Right.
Now they're really in trouble because now there's nothing to stop the Yetzer Hara anymore. So now he gets to the point where he's willing to cross the line that he wouldn't have crossed before.
Mm-hmm.
Yichud wasn't prohibited. David's Beis Din said, oh, you see, you can't have Yichud. Yichud causes people to cross lines. Then we have to outlaw Yichud. So Amnon, at this point, loses all perspective and says to her, let's do the Avera. Tamar says to him, we can accomplish the same thing and it will be permitted. It's okay. David will say yes. If we've gotten this far already, David will say yes. He's not going to say no, even though it may not normally have been done. But here we have a situation where the choice is an Avera or a Mitzvah. So let's make it a Mitzvah.
Right.
And she was right, because this was prior to the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash. And therefore, it would have worked. It would have worked. The failure over here was, again, Yichud. Because it's true, it would have worked. In a controlled setting, you have a man who's going to die if he can't have a relationship with her. And if this story was before the Beis HaMikdash, before the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. Or Tu B'Av. Women are dancing and the men are coming and watching and a man gets very enamored with a particular woman. But they're in public. Nothing can be done right now. Even if he wanted to, nothing could be done right now. They're both there in public. Well, that's a very public setting, Tu B'Av. I mean, everybody's all over the place. So, what will happen? He'll become enamored and he'll want to marry her. Because he'll want to be able to go forward. And we'll say, great. And we'll arrange a chuppah. And we'll set up shidduchim. It'll be wonderful. Great. It'll be terrific. But when you add to that a yichud situation, then the Yetzer Hara says, I'm not waiting. I'm not interested in waiting. It's true. It may be just as enjoyable in a permissible way. But I'm not waiting. That's going to take time. That means to put off instant gratification for later. I'm not interested. That's the failure over here. What Yichud does is it says that whatever you want can be done now. And now is very enticing. Now is always enticing. To say that we know, the whole struggle that we have in this world is put off instant pleasure for later pleasure. Or later pleasure for even later pleasure. That's the whole struggle, isn't it? We know intellectually we're going to get immense pleasure in the next world. But the next world is a long time from now. We all hope it's a really long time from now, right? So it's going to be a long time. But the pleasure in this world is right now. I don't have to wait. We know that as little kids, they can't put off, you know, you offer them a candy bar right now. For a dollar, and I'll take you to the store, and we'll buy 6 candy bars. More often than not, they're going to want the dollar bar, the candy bar right now, because it's now. 6 later is not as good as 1 right now. It's very, very enticing. Yichud makes the act available now, and that trumps everything. So even though this was prior to the destruction, and therefore, in theory, the desire could have been substituted, and it would have been fine. They could have gotten married. But his desire was for the sin. It was for a sin. It was for out of wedlock, and it was for a sister. That's why he says sister all the time. He was interested in the sinful relationship with his sister. Incest. That's what he was interested in. Remember, before the second Beis HaMikdash, that was very possible and very plausible that a person would desire a sibling, and it's sinful, it's incest, not allowed to. But the not allowed to act upon that desire, but to have the desire is definitely possible. He wanted to live with his sister. He didn't want to live with a wife.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And even though in their day, substituting wife for sister would have worked, just like substituting a single woman for your wife would work, but you can't compete with now. You can't compete with that. If it can be happened right away,
to say, let's go talk to David, and he won't... We'll have the chuppah next week.
Mm-hmm.
Next month. Well, right away, we're on. It's too much. It's too much time. It's too long to wait.
Because it's not now.
Because it's
not now. I think a good support for this premise is the fact that he became lovesick instead of simply asking her to marry him. I mean, he obviously felt barred from pursuing
his desires. He clearly felt that way. Yeah.
So he knew that there was a barrier there, or he would have acted earlier.
Yeah. It's clear he did not think he could do this in a permissible manner until she says it later. And he knew that halakhically he could. He didn't think it would actually happen.
Even at that point, though, was it also that he didn't want to think about that happening because the sinful aspect is what really kept him interested?
I believe that's the case.
Yeah.
I believe that's the case.
He wasn't interested in finding a solution.
Not anymore.
Solution.
Not at that point. Prior to that, maybe, but not at that point. Not at that point. Once a person is so entrenched in the Avera, it's very difficult to extricate oneself.
I think another strong support for this is that David's reaction was not to kill Amnon or drive him out or anything. His reaction was to institute Yichud.
Right. Now we have to talk about the reaction. That is true. And we have to actually talk about David in general over here. What was he thinking and his reaction? Now, let's take the reaction first, even though it's the second thing chronologically, but let's take it first. David's reaction, as you said, is to institute Yichud. David is upset by the whole story. But the story is understandable. Once you inject the fact that brothers and sisters could desire each other, number one. Number two, Yichud is permissible.
Mm-hmm.
You put those things together, it's understandable that this happened. Now, why didn't David take more punitive action? I believe we're going to see that Yoav is going to take Avshalom is going to take extremely punitive action. But it seems to me there was no need to, because remember, Tamar, mm-hmm. in her resistance, permanently maimed Amnon. So what do you do already? I mean, he's now permanently maimed. There's nothing more to do. I mean, I don't know what else he's going to do. Is he going to kill his son for having done this? It was a very bad thing to do. But what is he going to do? It's not. He didn't do an act for which Beis Din would put a person to death. She wasn't a married woman.
Mm-hmm.
Now. And she was technically not his sister. So even if she was his sister, well, okay, forget if she actually was his sister, but technically she was permitted to him. So essentially what he did is he molested a single girl, which is definitely bad. I'm not trying to downweigh that at all, but what do you want them to do?
Mm-hmm.
What should we do? So if he came out of this totally unscathed, I could see David and Beis Din taking some punitive action. There's got to be some retribution over here. Whatever it is, you're going to have to take care of her for the rest of your life. You have to marry her. You have to take care of her financially, whatever it is. But he came out of here maimed also. So I believe that it's almost like, okay, you know, everybody got hurt over here. So now what? He was wrong. Okay, God will have to take care of that. I mean, there's only so much that we as human beings can do in these circumstances. But what was David thinking in the beginning? This is the most challenging part of the story, as far as I'm concerned. David acquiesces to Amnon's request. What is David thinking? Now, I'm going to give you two suggestions, the first of which is a lot easier to accept, but is a lot more simplistic. Second one, I have no proof to this, but I'm going to suggest it anyway, only as possibility, conjecture, but a possibility. First approach I mentioned to you last week. Remember, David is very vulnerable. David knows that he is going to get punished, and he is going to lose children. He's already lost one. He knows he's got to lose three more. The very next thing after the loss of the baby is he's called to his son Amnon. His eldest son, Amnon, is lying in bed sick. So it's not shocking at all that David would jump to the conclusion he's the next victim. And ironically, David was right. He is the next victim, he and Tamar. But David thinks, that's it. The baby died, and now Amnon is starting to suffer. He's got a sickness, and he's going to die. This is my punishment. God is punishing me for what I did. Now, we haven't yet tackled the question of how can Hashem punish David by hurting somebody else, which is a significant question, which we'll have to deal with. But we know it's happening. We know that is what's happening. So we will have to put it on the back burner, but we are going to get to it at some point, Mr. Hashem. So David comes to visit Amnon, and Amnon has this request. It would not be going out on a limb to say that David was not thinking clearly over here. He's very vulnerable. We mentioned last week this is part of how much of a scoundrel Yonadav is. Because Yonadav knows that David is vulnerable, and he knows that Amnon can easily take advantage of David's vulnerability. Go fake that you're about to die. David's going to make that assumption right away. You don't have to fake it too much. He's going to right away assume you're the next victim. And then you'll get out of him whatever you want. So when Amnon says, bring my sister, you can say that David just didn't think it through because he was so lost in his own grief over the fact that this is my next son who's going to die. I think that's a plausible explanation. It doesn't. You know, that sort of thing doesn't resonate with me that David wasn't thinking straight. David is David. I mean, in my book, he always thinks straight. So, but one could make that suggestion. Yeah.
You may have also thought that given Amnon's sickness and how sick he appeared, that nothing could really happen.
Right.
I mean, if you've got a really sick person, right, in bed, then you're not thinking that they're going to attack somebody and
right.
molest them like
right.
that.
Right. That is true too. That is true too. You might have thought that there's
not
nothing.
A normal, healthy person who's lying there. And
right. Right. But to miss the signs when Amnon
right.
says, "I want her to come and
right.
feed me," and like, what are you thinking, Amnon? Like, right. okay, but he looked very sick, and David was afraid for his life. I mean, you know, okay, fine. The second suggestion is granted conjecture, and I have no proof to this, but I want to put it on the table for your consideration, and you'll see how it fits into the general rubric of everything that we've just talked about this evening. What if, when David came to Amnon, David correctly diagnosed Amnon as being lovesick? It's the same word that it says. It says in Pasuk Beis, Amnon became, it was painful for Amnon lehischalos, to become sick. And then Amnon tells him in Pasuk, I'm sorry, then Yonadav tells him in Pasuk He, in verse 5, Shkav al mishkavcha, lie on your bed, vehischol, and be sick. Now, that's not shocking, it's the same word. Sickness is sickness. But he's sick, but he really is sick. He's lovesick.
But the word means make yourself sick.
Yeah.
He's making himself
yeah.
sick.
Yeah.
He's
yeah.
not just objectively sick. He's bringing this on himself.
Yes. Yes. What if David correctly recognized Amnon's sickness as being a lovesickness? What if he actually recognized that?
Mm-hmm.
And then Amnon says, I want Tamar to come, etc., etc. And our question was, how did David miss that? I mean, it's so obvious.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so maybe David wasn't thinking straight. But if David was thinking straight, how did he miss it? What if he didn't miss it? What if he actually understood exactly what Amnon wanted? And nevertheless, he told Tamar, go do it.
Mm-hmm.
So you say, what? How would you do that to your daughter? Go put her in a situation like that. Perhaps the answer is that David recognized right away what's going on over here. That Amnon is lovesick, and he desires Tamar. And that Amnon is embarrassed to ask for her hand in marriage, because it's an unusual relationship. So David says, fine, I'm going to allow things to play out over here. Because what's going to happen? She's going to go feed him. He's going to get really lovesick, and then he'll ask for her hand in marriage. David doesn't anticipate what's going to end up happening.
Right.
He didn't say, Tamar, go there and be alone with him. There was none of that. What he's doing over here is he's saying, fine, we'll make a shidduch. He's embarrassed to ask me. And for whatever reason, David doesn't want to suggest it, because perhaps that will be embarrassing to his son. So let it play out. Like Rashi says, if it would have worked over here, it'll be a mitzvah. Fine. We'll make a shidduch over here. Let it play out. So let her go. Let her feed him. And perhaps the way David said it to Tamar even indicated the whole thing, because when Tamar did this for Amnon, perhaps Tamar understood, that's an unusual thing to send me to do.
Mm-hmm.
Must be that we're making a shidduch over here.
Mm-hmm.
And Tamar herself wasn't guarded in the way she prepared the food, to the point where Amnon got the wrong message from her. Maybe it wasn't so wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Tamar wasn't guarded because this was what David was telling her to do. Go there, let it play out, and you'll get married. The problem was Yichud.
Mm-hmm.
Yichud messed up the plan, because Yichud wasn't prohibited yet, and no one anticipated what Yichud would do. First of all, that they would end up with Yichud, and where they would end up because of Yichud. That at that point, you couldn't substitute anymore. That is, what I'm telling you is purely conjecture. It does fit with the general way that we're approaching the story.
I think it fits very, very well. I think it answers a lot of questions.
Right, and plus that what she chose to make him was a very long, drawn-out,
right.
involved process.
Right.
She could have made him muffins and been out of there in 30 minutes.
She could have said no at any point.
And she could have said no.
She could have said, don't send out the people. I mean, she could have said no.
She could have had a right of refusal along
the whole time. Now, let's be very careful over here. Remember, Tamar is a great tzaddik.
Right.
We're not suggesting anything she did was wrong.
No.
We're just saying that playing along with this wasn't necessarily wrong until the point that he grabs her.
Right.
Until that point, and then she does resist.
Right.
But until that point, it wasn't necessarily wrong.
Right. Right.
But the mistake of not realizing that once they got to that point, there was no substituting anymore.
Right.
Because now can't be resisted, or it's very difficult to resist that. So this is the Tamar and Amnon story.
Can I ask one more question? Is there any link at all, because we had two Tamars in Tanakh?
Yeah, there is discussion about that.
We have apparently inappropriate relationships, with modest women and having actual relationships with people that they're related to that they normally shouldn't be, and so on and so forth.
Except
one turns out to be very good, and one turns out to be...
Well, and Tamar also is a very modest woman here.
Right, I'm seeing a lot of parallels.
Just like over there. You have to believe that if David named her
Tamar,
that he's thinking about his own ancestor. Tamar is the mother of all of David's line.
Right.
So you have to believe that he had that in mind.
It can't be coincidental.
No, it can't be coincidental.
We don't have any major names like that are repeated. Major names.
Yeah, I mean,
there's some minor names. But that really stands out.
Yeah, that does stand out. Okay, now, this is, I believe, a solid approach to this whole story. But no matter how you understand the story, the next step, which is going to be Avshalom's revenge, it picks up. No matter how you understand the story, the result is that Tamar has been violated, and any future she had is now going to be completely different. And Amnon is definitely at fault, and Avshalom is going to make sure that he pays for it. So that, Mr. Hashem, we will continue with next week. For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it, so that he can continue that site.